When considering ways to address climate change on an individual basis, scale is an issue because climate change is a global problem and we are just us. It seems like the question often asked is, what can I do? Our guest this hour gets us to think about what we have already done. The things we've bought, taken, and consumed have had impacts on the planet already, and advertising is often telling us we need more. So Hope Jahren wrote the book, The Story of More, How We Got to Climate Change and Where to Go from Here. Hope Jahren is a scientist, writer, and teacher. Her field of specialty is paleobiology, and Hope taught and did research for years at the University of Hawaii. Since 2016, she's held a professorship at the University of Oslo in Norway. Her previous book, a bestseller, was Lab Girl. Hope Jahren, welcome to The Exchange.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. Sounds like that web report sounded like the fog report from where I sit.
Oh, is it very foggy where you are in Oslo now?
Oh, no, no, no. It seemed like she was reporting on fog conditions during times of the day.
Oh, yeah. We get that morning fog for sure to start
the
day.
Yeah, I picture a beautiful green place with heavy fog dripping off the leaves and things like that. It sounds wonderful.
It is. But you have a great quote to start the book. It's Thomas Edison talking to Henry Ford and Harvey Firestone. What did he say?
Well, he pushed renewable energy on them. You know, he said that, wow, you know, the sun is such a great source of energy. I hope that somebody will look into that someday before oil and coal all run out on us. And it was the guy who invented the light bulb talking to the guy who invented the car and the guy who invented the tire. And I sort of see them at a dinner party, and I see them all smiling and nodding, and then they go their separate ways and go on and motorize the planet until we have what we have today. But my point with that was sort of, I think it's kind of goofy and funny, and I do try to be funny in the book in the places it allows. But it is kind of interesting to think about how people really have been talking about climate change and global change and energy use for, this is not a new thing that our media cooked up in the last 10 years. This is 30 years, 40 years, 50 years.
And beyond that, you point out that some scientists began talking about greenhouse gases and the possibility that they could accumulate back around 1896 or so.
Yeah, very soon after they figured out the physical properties of carbon dioxide as a gas, you know, the nature of the bond between the carbon and oxygen molecules, they also figured out that it would retain radiative heat if you ran it through it. And it wasn't such a big step before folks started thinking about, well, gosh, you know, what would this do to our atmosphere? And that was in the 1800s, right? So the ideas behind what we're seeing today have been floating around, and they're actually simple ideas that can be explained straightforwardly and respectfully and in the form of a story. And that's what I really tried to do in this book, is to tell how the world got this way as a story, our story of the last 50 years of the way we've been living. The wonderful things that we've done to build the world that we have today have all come with side effects, and part of the side effects are the temperature rise that we see now, the sea level rise, and the melting. And you know, that kind of shows us where we are. We're at this crossroads. And the question now is do we want to be here? What are we going to do about it? But I really think we can only make those decisions with our eyes open if we can really look at how it is that we got here. You know, because the discourse is kind of broken down into, there must be an enemy, there must be a big, bad interest.
Somebody's got a motive for feeling one way or the other, yeah.
Yeah, that everything is so polarized, right? So there's got to be a good guy and there's got to be a bad guy, you know, like an Avengers movie. You know, somebody made this big mess and they've got to, you know, we've got to conquer them or shout them down or some kind of thing, and then this will all go away. And what's really true is that this is the natural consequence of post-war industrialization on up to what we enjoy today. You know, the objects of our landscape have come to use energy. Our toothbrushes use energy. You know, we don't rake leaves anymore. We blow them around. You know, we don't have caddies. We ride around golf courses, stuff like that. And our attitude toward energy, it's receded so far into the background, I think we don't even realize how much we use and what we're using it for. And until we can kind of wrap our heads around that, we also can't approach questions about, well, would cutting back make a difference? And if you look at the numbers, you find out that it really could.
Yeah, it really could. So given the enthusiasm that you portray both in person and in the book, I was surprised to read in the book of your reaction when your department chair at the University of Hawaii said, please teach climate change.
Yeah, that was kind of how the book started, was, you know, my department chair called me into his office and he said, hey, you know, we need a class on climate change because this is something, you know, students want to take and we need somebody to take this on. And I kind of groaned and slouched down and said, you know, because talking to people about these things is, you know, nobody wants to be preached at about their energy use or about their personal habits or, you know, I mean, to me, it's a little bit like talking about healthy eating or non-smoking or something like that. Everybody knows that, you know, conservation is good and eating healthy is good, but there's strong forces, there's strong commercial forces cooking up ways 24/7 to try us to get to do the opposite, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what the message usually resorts to is this kind of preaching or this kind of guilting or this kind of, and I just didn't want to be a mechanism for that because I could also look at my own life and say, you know, these students live quite simple lives. A lot of them don't have cars. A lot of them, you know, are living on campus and they're eating in a communal setting. And my carbon footprint is bigger than theirs. What am I going to stand up on my hind legs and talk about how a person should do? You know, there's just these levels of kind of ridiculousness to it. And so I thought, well, what would be the right way to do this?
So we're talking about the approach you wanted to take. You said there was a right way to do this, and what did you figure out that was?
Well, I took it at face value. I said, well, if they want a class on global change, then I'll figure out what there is to know about global change. And I went back to my office, and I simply sat down at all these marvelous databases, you know, the good people at the Environmental Protection Agency, the USDA, the CDC, the NIH, you know, the Weather Service and the crop surveys and the USDA, all these places have been putting together the data that describes our lives. You know, how many bushels of corn have been exported over the last week, you know, in the last 24 hours, how many turnips have fallen off the truck and how much oil has been burned in furnaces in factories in New Jersey and things like that. You can find all that data if you sit down and look for it. And so for years I sat down and I cataloged the story of how food production has changed over the last 50 years, how energy consumption has changed over the last 50 years, how garbage production has changed, let's see, how sugar consumption has changed, how the different reservoirs of metals, you know, that are imported and exported have changed. And just put together a story of what have the last 50 years been like in terms of resources, in terms of the way things move around and how much they get used. And the amazing thing was I saw patterns that held very, very strongly. In that there's, well, it all comes down to more. And that might not surprise you in that there's more of everything now than there was 50 years ago. There's more people, there's more stuff, etc. But there's another thing that I call more, right? So there's more and then there's more, right? So there's been two times the number of people. So the number of people has doubled. But the amount of food produced has tripled. Three times the amount of seafood, three times the amount of grain, three times the amount of meat, four times the amount of sugar, three times the amount of fossil fuel use, four or five times the amount of electricity use. And we can go on and on like that. So yes, the world is doubled in the amount of people, but our consumption along almost any index I could look up has exploded relative to that. And it's not just, amazing if it were evenly distributed, but it's not. Most of that tripling and quadrupling of resource use all happened within about 20% of the global population, which is Europe and North America and Japan and Australia and New Zealand.
So
right?
Places that were already doing pretty well, were prosperous and had stuff.
Right, exactly. And so if you look at things like folks that are literally dying because they don't have enough to eat, right? So there's about 1 billion people that qualify as malnourished or undernourished according to the United Nations standards. The amount of, if we divided up the entire food supply, and that's with making meat, we could adequately feed people at, you know, between 2,000 to 3,000 calories a day, every single person on Earth, right? So, and we saw that, I saw that again and again with energy as well. You know, the basics of life, we need sterile instruments at hospitals. We need light so you can get home, light so you can study after dinner, stuff like that. If you were to equitably divide up everything we produce on Earth now, you could put out enough for every person there. So all the hunger and the want that we see in the world is due to our inability to share, not the inability of the Earth to produce. And I remember that was one thing that came to me that really, really struck me, was that, and that's kind of at odds with folks are really, really nervous about overpopulation. But it's actually the overpopulation of the subset that's doing so terribly much consumption that's threatening the Earth's ability to produce for the other 90%, right?
Wow.
So the more I thought about this, the more I got to, you know, how do we look at pulling back on the things we don't need to do, and I'll come back to that, and better distributing what we can do.
Couple of points. Let me remind our listeners who we're talking to. This is Hope Jarn is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a scientist, writer, teacher at the University of Oslo. Her book is The Story of More, How We Got to Climate Change and Where to Go from Here. I want to drill further into things like food production, because you talk about, you grew up near Iowa. You take us into corn country. Yeah. The yields are huge. You were talking about some of that earlier, how many bushels of corn were exported yesterday. You got into numbers like that. Are we making too much, or just too much going to the wrong places?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of the grain that we make isn't eaten by anybody, even if we count animals. So we eat very little of the grain compared to what we feed the animals, and now there's a whole new source, and that's converting that grain into fuel, which is a new thing. As of the year 2000. So it's a new thing for our century. But this idea of planting seeds in order to grow food, in order to take that food and convert it back into fuel, of course, some of which is used to run tractors to plant more seeds, is kind of a, when you think about it, it's really an incredible place that we've gotten to, where we're actually taking part of the food supply and turning it into food for our cars, you know, which have really, really taken over the planet if you look at the numbers of cars out there as well and how far we're driving. Mm-hmm. That was another statistic that exploded over the last 50 years.
Now, Austin, Minnesota, your hometown, is home to a factory that where Spam was first created, and you talk about how quickly it's consumed. But that is the point. I mean, and it's not just the consuming, but the inputs that go into the process. I mean, what are the impacts specifically of meat production on the planet?
Right. Okay. So I come from a town where there's basically one industry in town, and it's a slaughterhouse, and they slaughter upwards of 30,000. Pigs a day there, which sounds fantastic, but it's actually true. I mean, that's the volume at which we do these things in the United States. What we have to remember when we slaughter an animal is that we're also bringing to the knife several years of work. Right? We've got to birth these things and raise them and feed them and keep them healthy and then slaughter them, and then we get a little bit of meat from all those resources we put in. We get a little bit of meat, we get an awful lot of manure, and then we get the time that they were alive, the 1 or 2 years or whatever. So it's a very inefficient use of that grain. You know, that being said, I think there's a place for meat. I mean, I think meat is something people have consumed for various reasons and people will continue to consume. I think one of the traps we've set for ourselves is to try to present these ideas as all or nothing. You know, do you swear off meat or do you not pay any attention to how much you eat? Well, there's a lot of middle ground there. And I show the calculations of if everybody went one meatless meal a week, you could free up enough grain to, it's something like if the, Europe and the United States and North America and Japan, Australia, New Zealand, if you could do one or two meatless nights a week, you could free up about enough grain to feed a good part of India for almost a year.
Wow.
Right? So there are spaces in between these hard and fast positions that we've taken about, demanding that we adopt, veganism or vegetarianism or throw the whole idea away or something like that. And so that's another thing I try to do, is to get people to look at the middle. You know, is there a place in the middle where I can use less without, because all of this polarization, I think, is taking us to a place of paralyzation.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think what I'm hearing you say then, Hope, is that where we have often wondered, what we could do is not much differently. I mean, if you do a little bit differently, you're talking about make a change here and there. Look for ways that you can live your values. We get into in the back of the book. We'll talk about that more later. But the idea being that each person with their own individual increase in consumption contributed to this. So each person with a decrease in consumption can also contribute. You don't have to.
And it's also, it's changing the mindset. You know, there's no better. And I, I'm a teacher, so I work in the classroom. And you change people's minds by doing, not just by, telling them this, and is right, et cetera. You do it with them. And through doing it, they decide whether or not they want it to be a habit. And it's the repetition of those processes, of those, it's doing it and thinking about it that changes people's values and changes their thinking. And I think if we had, if we were a group of people that knew more and were more sensitive to when we use energy and to the things in our lives that use energy, I believe, very hopefully, that we would naturally become people who made more informed decisions about what energy use is worth it and what energy use really isn't contributing to our lives.
Hope Jaran is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Story of More, How We Got to Climate Change and Where to Go from Here. It's a conversation you are welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number is 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation. You can also send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from William in Sutherland. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, good morning. Well, what changed my whole outlook on all this was the years I spent in the poorest slums in Lima, Peru.
Tell me about that.
Well, these people, they didn't have any money. They were dirt poor. And I realized how fortunate we are here in the United States to have what we have. We're wasting everything. If you want to see waste, come to Douglas County, Oregon. I'll show you around.
What do you think the worst wastes are?
Well, one of them is Douglas County was the last county that had free dumping of garbage.
Mm-hmm.
So now we started paying and we have no service. We don't recycle anything. The only thing we recycle is used motor oil and metals.
Huh.
No glass, no cardboard, nothing.
No milk jugs, nothing like that?
So it all goes in the dump. So I save all mine up, and I go to Eugene maybe three or four times a year, but not for that. But when I go up there, I take all my stuff and take it over to the Linwood, and they take everything.
Wow, that's a very full truck then, isn't it, on that trip?
Yeah. Especially my little Toyota pickup.
Right. All right, William, thank you for sharing the story. I very much appreciate that. Thoughts from you, Hope?
Yeah, it's hard to get a good handle on the data, but the best reliable sources that I could come up with are saying something like 40% of the food that we grow and produce in the United States and eventually ends up in the garbage. And there's very many different places where this can happen. You know, food rots on trucks and it rots on the shelf and it gets scraped into the garbage from restaurants and all that kind of stuff. And when we do that wasting of 40%, we're also wasting, you know, all the labor and all the, not just the stuff itself, but all the labor of, you know, driving that stuff around and labeling it and evaluating it for freshness and all that kind of advertising for it and everything like that. And so there's a massive amount of wasted effort. There's wasted chunks of our life in all that garbage. And so actually thinking about, you know, how can I create less garbage is a healthy thing to do in terms of thinking about how can I sort of reclaim my life from all of this. But again, we need a way to get folks to realize, you know, just how much garbage they produce and the sort of little practical things. Again, I'm a teacher in the classroom, you know. Do you find yourself scraping one thing over and over and over again into the garbage? What is that thing? Try not buying it for a week and see what happens. These sound like very, very small efforts. And it's very easy to get overwhelmed by a world with too many problems. But there is great power in changing your thinking. Mm-hmm. That is something that can affect the trajectory of your whole life. And I don't say that because I'm naive. I say it because I see it year after year after year in the classroom. And I wrote down my best ideas as to how to go about this. And that's what you get out of the book.
Now, we have an email here from Estelle, no town given, but she writes, please speak to the fact that grain can still be used for animal feed after it has been used for biofuel. It is a superior feed to grain that has not been fermented, writes Estelle.
Yeah, now, folks that take issue with the idea of using grain for fuel production are quick to say, you know, it's not necessarily the edible parts of that grain that are used. And there is a lot of specificity that goes into choosing, you know, what part can go to animals and what part can go into that. So it's not a simple process where you just have a pile of grain and you shuffle some of it over. But even with those technologies, it still comes down to the fact that you're turning calories into fuel. There's no escaping that. And the fermentation argument about bringing it back to the animals after it's fermented, I don't think you can get the fuel all the way out if you don't ferment it fully. But she may be talking about something very specific. Again, that's a very, very small part of what we see in the general budget of how say ethanol is made from sugarcane in Brazil.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into energy consumption generally because you know we've talked about in fact your book is all about how marvelously we've been able to produce more, you know, the more with we can get greater crop yields, we can get animals to grow faster, our cars are more efficient, that sort of thing. But as energy efficiency increased, didn't consumption increase anyway?
Yeah, we offset that. There's sort of this road not taken, where there was the oil crisis back in the 70s, and there was an effort toward conservation then. And it's kind of amazing, you know, that there actually, those of us who can remember there was actually a social effort to use less energy, you know, stop doing this, stop doing that, do less of this, do less of that. And it's a patriotic thing to use less energy. And that's kind of gone away somehow. And that was associated with the oil crisis of the 1970s when we realized that we're almost completely dependent on a foreign source for our main energy, resource. Now, what came out of that was a big engineering effort to make cars, airplanes, et cetera, more fuel efficient, get them to do more with less fuel in them. Once the oil prices changed, of course, we offset all that efficiency we gained by building much, much bigger cars that weighed more and driving them further and further and further, right? So the average amount of commuting went way up. Mm-hmm. Our cities began to sprawl, and all of a sudden, what used to be farm trucks and basically, you know, SUVs for hard country driving became stuff you drove around the city and into the suburbs, right? So there was and you see this in a lot of fields. There was this sort of melancholy road not taken, where we could have taken advantage of all that in improved efficiency, but we didn't. We doubled down, and we used more things, and we used them harder, and we ended up burning even more fuel.
Here's a phone call from Lizelle in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am calling, I'm really grateful to be hearing this conversation. It's something that's on my mind a lot. And living here in Southern Oregon, I live out of town, outside of Grants Pass, and I find myself so often just lamenting how much I drive. I have kids who I have to get to school, and of course all of their activities as well, and I'm in my car so much. And I feel like since I've moved back to Southern Oregon, away from the cities, and have a garden and a wonderful network of farm community, there's so many ways I've reduced my impact, I feel. Like, my food waste is way less, and I have animals to feed what we do not eat to, so that it gets cycled back in. But it's the gas consumption is huge, and I'm a person who dreams big, and I love to be a part of creating some better system of transportation around here, but I don't really know what that might look like in a rural setting like this, where I don't know if buses out here make sense, and I would just love to hear any input, ideas, maybe models from other places that that your guests.
Okay. Very thoughtful question, Lizelle. Thanks for that. And I should point out, too, that this is a very hot issue in Oregon at the moment, Hope, because the recent legislative session just broke up with a walkout and failed for the second time to pass a bill that was addressing climate change through a cap-and-trade program. The Republicans walked out of the legislature in successive sessions and prevented that from happening. And one of the major complaints was increase in gasoline and diesel fuel costs for rural areas.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm from a rural area, so I get that, right? I encourage people, and I want you to tell me if I'm getting at what you're saying, because I want to make sure that I get at the heart of what you're asking. I encourage people to look at their energy use as a whole profile, as opposed to not just one activity, because we're all living different lives. And of course, folks in rural areas are living very different lives than folks in urban areas. And it's much easier to cut out certain things, and it's much harder to cut out, you know, driving if you're a couple miles from, you know, the nearest convenience store where you can even get a bottle of aspirin when you're not feeling well. But every single one of us has a different sort of energy profile and a different constellation of things that are optional. So somebody living in the city who's sort of your counterpoint part there in Portland, they may have the option to live without a car, but they may be forced to, participate in some things that cost a lot more energy than you do. Maybe they're flying twice a year to see some relatives, whereas your family is much closer by. It's also very easy to feel like no matter how much you do, it's never enough, or to get fixated on one bad, bad, bad thing that that you do. And it's also very easy, for people to tell other people that they're bad and they're not doing enough, et cetera. It would be wrong for me to get on the radio and tell people how they should change their lives, right? Because you know best about your life. And what I try to do in the book is to help people sit down and say, well, let's make an energy budget for our household. What are the things that are optional, and what are the things that just plain are not optional? Mm-hmm. What are the things that use the most energy? You'd be surprised at the amount of energy that you can save with your water heater and with your AC and with your heating. And that is just as valid as taking energy approach on driving as well.
Right? More directly to Lizelle's point, though, I'm curious to know, like in other countries, because obviously Norway has rural areas too. Public transportation is pretty awful in rural areas in the United States, but I wonder if it's any better there.
There's trains that go almost everywhere, but mm-hmm. there's certainly not subways in any of the cities here except Oslo to any great extent. Certainly, folks in rural areas find the need to drive to get places. Not sure. One thing I hear a lot about is, you know, electric cars potentially solving these problems, if we can get to the point where we're using more electric cars, et cetera. I try to get people to think about the fact that there's no free lunch, you know, because if we do go strongly committing towards electric cars, we've got to start asking hard questions about where all those metals are going to come from. Where is all that lithium going to come from, cadmium, iron? A lot of that is sourced in ways that, you know, if we look at the details of it, it's not exactly comfortable. We're kind of replacing dependency on one foreign import with dependency on another. So it really does come down to the issue of why are we driving? When do we need to drive? Do we all need to drive?
And maybe we can share.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's bring in another comment here. Diane in Myrtle Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Hope Jarin, the author of The Story of More. Hi.
Hi. Okay, what I've got to say is I have to build a fence. I'm a little old lady, and I have to build a fence, and instead of getting a tractor, I harness my horse. I hitch her to the wooden lumber I have to go, and we drive across the pasture. I think that saves a lot of energy, and it's also good for your soul.
Interesting. Are you in the process of building the fence now?
Yes, and I have to hand dig the fence posts.
Wow, how are you feeling?
I am feeling great. When you do this, it makes you feel so much better. There's something for a horse that's good for you, and it's a wonderful thing to do.
Okay, thanks for sharing the story, Diane. Appreciate that.
What's your horse's name?
Oh, let me get the back on. Diane, what's the horse's name? Oops, she got off. Sorry.
Yeah, my dad was born in 1923, and it was in a tiny little town, Minnesota, and it was horses then. You know, the first cars hadn't shown up, and he's always told these stories about how people talked about how cars would never replace horses, because why would you ever buy a black metal box that you couldn't even see how good it was when, you know, you had a horse and you knew it, and it had a personality, and you could tell how hard it was going to work, and you could rely on it and stuff like that. It made me smile and made me think of him when she told her story. There's a lot in my book where I tell those kind of stories. I tell that story about my dad. I tell stories about how we used to do things when we were younger. We did it without all these energy-consuming objects, right? I have the treadle sewing machine that my grandmother sewed clothes for umpteen kids and grandkids on, and now not only do our sewing machines, you know, electrical, you know, most of the clothes aren't even sewed anywhere near where people live. And these are changes, and, you know, there's always nostalgia for the past, but the question we want to ask each other is, are all these changes making our lives better? And certainly your caller would say, no way, there's nothing she loves more than to get out there with her horse. I don't know if that's realistic for everybody who wants to build a fence, but there is room to talk about, you know, we used to do this in a much more simple way, and somehow along the way we got dovetailed into acquiring all these energy-using objects in order to do the same thing and to do a lot more of it. And it's not making us any happier. I mean, that's one of the really tragic things that I discovered from doing this. If you look at these indices of happiness, and, you know, it's hard to make a study on how happy people are, but this data is better than me shooting off my big fat opinion. But if you look at that, we're not happier than we were 20 years ago, even though we've got so many more time-saving objects and, you know, energy-saving objects, that there's something about all this that we've done that hasn't really fed us in the way that we hoped it would. That's the idea that I get from that. I often, with my students, I say, you know, where did your grandparents go on honeymoon? Well, they probably went down to the, you know, ice cream shop. Where did your parents go? Well, they drove over to Mount Rushmore. Well, where did your cousin go on his honeymoon? Well, they flew down to Jamaica. Well, which marriage lasted longest?
Yeah, and which wedding cost the most, too, right?
Well, there you go. I mean, I don't know if it's the greatest example. It's a fun one to do with students. Mm-hmm. But it makes you, you know, the kind of the bar has been raised so high in terms of how much energy we use to do these things that we used to do much more simply, and it didn't seem to be it wasn't such an awful thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. So we have another email here. This is from Becca in Lane County. She says, to cover myself, I practice very low consumption, but why should our country and land continue to be filled with industrial farms so we can feed the rest of the world? Sharing in some ways is good, but why should we be responsible for the practices of corrupt governments and on and on? I assume she's talking about governments that don't feed their people well enough, like in North Korea. Cargo ships filled with donated food instead of consumer goods? That from Becca and
I mean, we should keep in mind that we get an awful lot of resources that we need very badly from other countries, and so the expectation that we should offer goods to other countries, that's global trade, right? That's sort of how global trade works. What she's reacting to is that there's waste on all these sides. That's really infuriating. And I think in some ways she's asking the same question I do, is how can we do these things? We can do all these wonderful things and we can do so much of it. Why can't we just cut out the part that's not benefiting anybody? Can't we cut out the part that's just leading to waste and to this emptiness that seems to be sort of clinging to us, even though we thought we were getting someplace better?
So you end up talking about, let me come first to renewable energy. I want to get a second here on that, because you say you'd like to harness the power of all the people talking about it. Is the enthusiasm for renewable energy overblown?
It is. You know, one of the wonderful things about the place we are, you know, we're kind of at this crossroads in history where we've got to make decisions about what we're going to do with the earth, because everything matters so much. And it's an exciting time to be alive, sort of. But all ideas should be on the table. You know, energy solution will be lots of everything. You know, there's not one technology that's coming to save us. What we do notice about renewables, about wind, solar,
hydro?
Hydro is quite large. You know, hydro is a good 10 to 18% of the global budget in terms of producing electricity. But when we look at wind and solar, we're really looking at less than 5%. Of the electricity that's produced in the United States, and much less than a couple percent of what's produced around the world. And scaling that up is a big, big issue. In fact, that's the hottest issue when people talk about renewables. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are good things, but at this rate, in the way those things function now, at their current efficiencies, scaling them up in order to provide most of the energy that we use for our daily activities in the United States, it's not a real thing. It's just not, right? Even if you assume these things working at their absolute biggest potential, you know, you need to replace entire states with solar panels in order to, you know, in order to even get this thing off the ground, right? So a combination of these technologies is going to be closer to an answer than one brand new cool solution that's going to come out of the blue and save us.
Right. So don't wait for the big technology to come along and save us. I've heard that before too. We have
No free lunch.
Final email here from Ann in Grants Pass, who says, I listen to an old-time radio station and they play old ads. It is really apparent that a lot of the trouble we are in now started then. One ad is clotheslines are for the birds, an ad for electric clothes dryers, and one is how happy people are not to have to take back their glass bottles. That from Ann in Grants Pass. Thanks for the perspective on that. Hope's book ends up with an appendix of action items, including, can you make your personal activities consistent with your values? So lots to think about here. The book is called The Story of More, How We Got to Climate Change and Where to Go from Here, the work of Hope Jahren at the University of Oslo. Hope, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Take care.